and how some people could never go without, but can moderate their intake successfully. This made total sense to me and described to a T the feeling that I was having. Once you come to terms with what you think and why, you can start working with your brain and your body in a more harmonious way. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, take the time to get to know you, the real you, what is working and what is not, so that you can work together and make the necessary changes to transition into the next phase of life. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. Someone through until the path was clear. That's when I found you. How I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on. All you needed was something beneath your wings. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Dear KBOO community, as you can see, we are back on the air. However, at the moment, we still have a major power outage issue at the station. Therefore, we cannot have live programming right now. We are not certain how reliable this temporary broadcasting system will be, but we will keep you updated. Thank you so much for supporting KBOO Portland.
KBOO's end-of-year drive is almost over. We invite you to become a member right now by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute during this last week of 2022, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $5,000. Thanks to the generous support of Garnier Vineyards in Mosher, Oregon. Hurry and join the KBOO family today and help us meet our $70,000 goal at kboo.fm/give. Together, we can do it.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly youth-centered podcast where we talk to artists to find out what they do and how they do it. And I'm Nicole Cabrera, and we're joined by the high school students of McDaniel.
And I'm Erica Thomas. For the remainder of this school year, we'll be live at McDaniel High School. This month, our guest is Nan Curtis. Welcome to the show, Nan.
Thank you.
I'll keep passing the mic and the camera around, and we'll let everybody introduce themselves.
My name is Sam. I'm a sophomore here at McDaniel, and I'm in the mixed media area linked to studies.
Who's your teacher?
Sarah Beth.
Sarah Beth. Is teaching mixed media art or is it multifaceted?
They're teaching English, but it's like multi teachers working together.
I'm Louie. I am also a sophomore and I'm in the same like mixed media like linked design thing. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
I'm Lainey. I'm also a sophomore. I'm also in mixed media. I think all three of us are in the same class. So.
Yeah.
Great. Welcome, Lainey.
I'm Sebastian. I am in two different journalism classes, and I'm a junior. I am an editor on the newspaper this year, so that's who I am.
Welcome back, Sebastian. Okay, great. Nan, can you tell the students a little bit about who you are and what
you
do?
Yes, I can. My name's Nan Curtis. I'm originally from Kentucky, and I went to graduate school in Ohio, and a bunch of us from graduate school decided to move to Portland, Oregon on a whim in 1992, and I've been here since. I was hired at Pacific Northwest College of Art shortly after I got here and started my teaching career, as well as exhibiting in the local galleries and Pacific Northwest in general along the West Coast with a couple of nationwide shows, even international shows, over the past 30 years, essentially. Oh my gosh, 30 years, that's right. And I have been a practicing artist that whole time. I retired from teaching just before the pandemic, wild timing, March of 2020. I gave notice, and I am really committed to my studio practice, which is, this is my studio back here, and in a new way, and spending a lot of time here. And then I'm also retraining to be an end-of-life doula, a death doula, to help people die. And there is, I'm trying to discover kind of the collision between my own art practice and my passion for helping people die, because it's more of a calling than a career. You kind of can do it or you can't. And apparently I'm someone that can. I've helped about 9 people die now, and it's pretty awesome and intense. And so that's kind of where my life is right now. I just got done with a really big art show for me that unfortunately closed like 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, right at the end of October. And hopefully, oh, I sent you guys my Instagram so that you could look at that for images. I did a lot of Instagram posting.
Thanks, Nan.
That's it.
A backwards intro.
Excellent.
Well, we heard a little bit about where you grew up in Kentucky and how you kind of managed to move out to Portland on a whim, you said?
Yeah, kind of. We just wanted out of Ohio.
As a fellow Ohioan, I can't blame you.
I actually think it's a pretty cool place now. People should move there.
It's a different scene, completely different place now. It's really cheap to live there, but also a lot of stuff has changed that makes it better to live. Anyway, so sometimes we do like to ask artists to share a little bit about what it was like for them growing up. So yeah, I lived in Ohio, and I've also lived in Kentucky. And even though I did have a really wonderful time when I was living in Kentucky, and I was becoming an artist when I was living there, I'm curious what it was like for you as a young person growing up in Louisville, and whether you thought when you were young, I want to be an artist, or whether that was something that happened later, and what kind of maybe role models or understandings of art did you sort of like come across in your youth?
Mm-hmm. So I'm the youngest of 4 kids, and there's a lot of years between us. So by the time I came around, my parents were like, whatever you want to do is fine. They've been pre-vetted, and, you know, and I was just always good at art in school. People encouraged me, you know, everybody got the same assignment. Mine won the award. I liked doing it. I actually spent time on it. And then I went to a really special high school called St. Francis High School. It was a private inner city high school. And we had an exceptional art teacher. And I will say that even up to that point, I had very good art teachers. Most of my art teachers were artists. And so they were coming to teaching through practice, which was fascinating. And so that was true. I lived in Chicago for a short amount of time, and that was true there. And then in my middle school, I also had a really good art teacher, Mr. Mucci. He was awesome. But then in high school, we had this exceptional experience, and the art teacher was amazing, and it was a small school. We had nude models in high school. I mean, they did some really outrageous stuff. We were exposed to Louisville, Kentucky has an excellent art museum called The Speed that was kind of like our classroom. We studied all kinds of artists and art and years, and it was definitely game changing. I ended up going to a really small liberal arts college in Ohio because my parents did not want me to go to art school. They supported me being an artist and encouraged me, but they didn't want me to go to, I wanted to go to Pratt in Brooklyn. In Brooklyn at that point, I mean, I don't know, it was a big city and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. That seemed scary to them. And so they wouldn't let me do that. But I found a college in Ohio called Worcester that had an independent study program for their senior year where you did 1 year focused on whatever your thing was. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty interesting because I could develop an entire body of work in a year. And so I ended up going to Worcester, which was exactly true. I developed a really sophisticated body of work. I loved my teacher. We had a sculpture teacher, a photo teacher, and then printmaking and drawing. They wouldn't even let us have nude models in my college after coming out of high school. They made them wear jock straps and bras. It was so weird. But, and so I'm not sure if it's lucky or not, but I kind of always knew what I was going to do. I went right out of high school in a good program into a college where I got my degree in studio arts. I graduated with an excellent body of work and went directly into grad school. By the time I moved to Portland with my MFA, I was 25. So I was young and the path was kind of written for me and no one stood in the way. My parents, when I mean encourage me, it means they didn't stand in my way. It's not like they were like, she's so great. Good job, Nan. They were just like, I think she's okay over there. You know, last one. But it just happened. Nobody ever stopped me from doing it. And let's be honest, making things is so fun. It actually, once you do it for as long as I have, you realize that it's kind of the way that you process your world. And so that is how you make sense of things. And that's, you know, right now, that's a pretty profound way to think it, by making things. So that's how I ended up making art.
Cool. I don't want to keep you guys waiting. Do you all have questions yet? Okay, that's fine. That's okay. I have lots of questions.
One thing I will say that just looking at all of you all, you know, I taught at Pacific Northwest College of Art for 27 years. You look like every one of my students. Like, you know, you're coming in, you have this diverse group of people. I love them. My favorite group of people to teach is freshmen. Those incoming ones, they're just like psyched. They can't believe they're at art school. It's totally incredible. And the energy, it's hands down the best thing. So looking at this image of who's in this room, it makes me so excited. There's the future. It's good stuff.
I really like what you have to say about using your work to process the world, and I agree that it is a really powerful thing, and especially also agree right now. And some of the questions that I have for you relate to, I'm actually really curious about your use of materials. I'm not a sculptor, but I've always had like a little crush on sculpture as a discipline, and I think it's interesting. The way I understand kind of the way that sculptors work, the sculptor is occupying space. So you're thinking a lot about space. And then you're also thinking about how to take materials and sort of like morph them into something new. And I know that there's a lot more things going on with sculpture, but just to break down like a few of the like elemental things that make sculpture sculpture for the students. So I'm curious... how your use of materials is something that you use to process your ideas, or if you have any kind of relationship with like this metamorphosis of ideas or materials.
So, materials are for me, and it's not true for all artists. A lot of artists come to their making like, you know, if they're using the same material all the time, take for instance, a painter. And yes, they're passionate about their materials, but they know what their materials are. They're using it based on their confidence of doing it. And I'm not going to say that's true for every painter, but they're not reinventing the wheel each time they go there. What they are reinventing is the image and the message that they're imparting on the viewer. For me, I'm always looking for new materials, and I like raw material. And in my studio back here, for those who can see it, I have a whole shelf of raw material. What that means for me is different from someone else. Like, I literally like raw cotton, rubber, sheets of rubber, plaster gauze. I like to body cast a lot. I like found objects. I like things like old diaries, because you know they're loaded with information, and even without reading it, you know that it's a personal object. And so you can kind of begin to relate to it as an object, even though you have no idea what's written on the inside of it. You had mentioned that thing about architecture, and I think a lot about that. So first off, the people that I moved to Oregon with were all architects. And sculptors definitely think about space, because it is, when you put a sculpture on the ground, it's on the same plane as you, as a person. And so you immediately begin to have a relationship to it that's different than, say, if it were on a pedestal or on a wall. It's just different. It's not better or worse. It's just different. And I really like to exploit that, to work with that aspect where you and whatever that object are on the same plane. And then you can begin to kind of communicate or work together in some ways. Very often my work will be participatory or activated by the viewer, so that there really is this kind of play that happens between viewer and the object that gets made. But so I'm always, materials are actually typically my starting point. And that's not true with a lot of people. Usually you have an idea and then you go to build it, or you have, you just have an essence or a sense of something you want to do. I will start with bed springs that I found at a dump. And then I will begin to work the material, and all of a sudden I have this amazing object, which is this orb of bed springs that rolls around on the ground and is kind of a goofy, weird little object. So I often use that material as my starting point. Sometimes I'll start with an idea. I'm working on my new idea is that I want to build a pile. And it doesn't have to, I mean, that's nondescript, right? That pile could be out of just about anything from dirt to blankets to old letters to a chair to, I have no idea. But I'm going to start, I want it to be big. So I'm going to have to use some stuff to make it big. And so I'm going to start looking for materials that would help me make a pile. I like the pile as a metaphor for family, because unlike that tree, the tree of life, the family tree that people talk about, my experience with family is not quite so aspirational. It's a little bit more of like stuff on top of stuff on top of stuff. And it's great. I mean, it makes for good connections with people in your family, but it's also heavy, just like you can imagine that a pile might be. So I like to use the pile as a metaphor for family, and I do a lot of that kind of work. How's that?
Great. Sebastian has a question.
You mentioned like seeing that family as like a pile. Have you ever tried to make a sculpture for that metaphor?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's my next project. I have done things. Sometimes I think about the family tree like a cloud. You know, a tree is so grounded. It's such an awesome object. It is both aspirational and well-grounded, and it makes me laugh that that's a metaphor for family, because that's just not typical of most families. They're not very well-grounded, and they're not particularly aspirational. And so I thought a cloud might be something that was a little more amorphous, and I started building clouds that were upholstered to the wall, and somehow that cloud looked like a pile to me, and all of a sudden that felt very aha. So I do want to physically build a huge pile in the middle of my studio, and quite frankly, I might just literally start grabbing everything from my studio and throwing it in there and then putting stuff on top, because I also feel like the weight or that burden that a pile feels, you know, nobody likes to be on the bottom of the pile when there's a pig pile or something, you know, that's a worse place to be. So I feel like that actually is a pretty great metaphor. Ultimately, too, piles are grounded because they do end up being very close to the ground. So maybe that, I just think that's a better metaphor. So yeah, I'm building a pile. That's my next big project. You guys don't tell anybody though, okay? I'm gonna see what happens. I'm a little nervous about it.
You mentioned earlier about like body casting. Do you ever like, well, first, with your art, do you ever like sell your art or do you keep all your art?
Oh no, I would love to sell it. People just don't buy it enough. I sold a little bit at this last show. It's probably one of my most lucrative shows, the one I made most on it. But I also, it's rare that I make a piece that's not for sale. I don't get overly connected to it. Check this out. I did a piece with all of my diaries and I put them inside of a clamp and I welded it shut so that nobody could actually read my diaries, and it sold to a museum. So now my diaries are in a vice grip, welded shut, but nobody can read them. But I always get really nervous about the fact that somebody might be able to get in there. I'm really good at body casting. It's one of the beginnings of my artwork. And maybe this is a good story to tell you all. When I was in graduate school, I think I mentioned to you, I was pretty young. And I had come out of undergraduate with a really good body of work. It was all plaster casts of real bodies, large scale, you know, figurative work. And halfway through graduate school, I didn't pass my first year of graduate school because they told me that I wasn't taking any risks and that I was doing the same thing over and over again, which was body casting. And I kept putting the figure in a different position and reworking it and doing things like that. And I made a lot of work, but they were right. I wasn't taking any risks. I was doing what I knew best. And it's not that you can't be that kind of artist. It's just not for grad school. If you're in grad school, they want you to take risks and do, you know, and try new things. So, but you surely could be a plaster cast artist and make those and actually probably make quite a good living off of doing that. But they told me that I should remove the figure from my artwork. And that was like the most destructive thing they could have told me. I mean, it was all I knew how to do. And so all of a sudden, I was left in the lurch. I didn't know what to do. And I started collecting materials. And that would be about the time where I shifted over into kind of hoarding materials. I was collecting driftwood off of the beach and old. We used to be able to go into the dump and take things out. They have actually a residency for it now, but when I was younger, all the artists would get their materials there and I would get stuff from there. And I produced a pretty interesting show in graduate school, but funny thing about graduate school, and which is often true for a lot of people, not just me, it's not when you make your best work. It's when you do your most growth. Some of your best work happens right after graduate school, when you're all of a sudden on your own and you literally just have to make because you want to, not because somebody's making you do it. But it was at that point that I realized that the figure in my work was the audience, not the object that I made. And so, but you know what I really like to do is body cast pregnant women. So I body cast them when they're pregnant, and then they have this like object of themselves when they were pregnant. So I keep doing that, and I really like plaster gauze as a material. It's really fun and easy, but I don't do a lot of body casting as much anymore.
And then another question I had, my freshman year of high school, I actually didn't go here. I went to another high school in Oregon, Clackamas High School, actually. And they have a really good ceramics class and a really good ceramics teacher and art teacher. Me and the art teacher didn't necessarily get along that well, but she was a really, really good teacher and art teacher. But me and my I took ceramics all year. Me and my ceramics teacher became very close, and she was a really good teacher and like really made me think about like that's what I maybe want to do when I'm older. And mm-hmm. So hearing that, like, you've always wanted to be an artist ever since you were little, at least that's what I'm hearing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I'm hearing.
No, I think that's right.
It shows that, like, not everybody